look up a word, find directions, mark a date on your calendar, check your email. 10 years ago, you'd have to go to any number of different websites to do those things, or even, gasp, use pen and paper. Today, you can do all of those things on Google and, of course, much more. Yesterday was the search engine turned everything engine's 10th birthday, and writer Rob Dubin decided to mark the day by not Googling anything for 24 hours. No maps, no Gmail, no calendar, documents, or photos. And he wrote about it in yesterday's Washington Post. We also want to hear from you. What was the moment when you realized you were hooked on Google? Lots of us use Google to search or for maps or for email, but are you an extreme Googler? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Rob Dubin is a writer for the Colbert Report, and he joins us now by phone from his office in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Dio. Thanks for having me.
And no Google for 24 hours. Did you make it? Or let me ask, how long did you make it?
Not even close. I made it around 13 hours before it caught me the first time. It was. It ended up being more like 55, 60 hours without Google, or attempting to go without Google.
And caught you the first time?
Yeah, actually, it was. I thought it was going to be easy because I knew I could avoid my email for a day. I'd done it before, and I figured I could just switch my default search engine in my browser to, you know, Yahoo or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, Yahoo was what I chose, but it was very surprising and a little bit unnerving how quickly it caught up with me. I reserved a Zipcar. I don't know.
Oh, one of those rental cars you can rent by the hour.
Yes, and they very helpfully have a map that pops up when you reserve your car, but it's a Google map. And so that was surprisingly sinister when it popped up.
Those maps that Google provides, I mean, they are so useful, but they're so ubiquitous now.
That's true. You can't avoid them. They're by far the most popular, which means they are by far the least avoidable.
And now, of course, Google is not only a service; it's a web browser of its own.
Yeah. If I wanted to be really strict with myself, it would have been hard for me to log into a lot of websites where I have accounts, because that's I have a Gmail account and that's my ID for websites. Like, if I was forbidden from even typing the name of one of their products, I would have had a real problem, I think.
Hmm. The odd thing about Google is that all of this is free.
Yes, that's how they get you.
Yeah. At the same time, they are collecting information about you.
Yeah. They give us a service in exchange for letting us use it. They're arguably the most successful voyeurs in history.
Voyeurs, it's almost like they're putting little sensors in your brain.
I think at some point we all fear that that's what's happening. We're certainly building a kind of dependence on it, even though it's avoidable. If you're going to use the internet, you're going to run into it eventually.
You quote the great horror writer H.P. Lovecraft in your piece. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. That, of course, an excerpt from The Call of Cthulhu.
That's right.
And, of course, Google does precisely that.
Actually, there's also a quote in there from Mr. Brin himself, the co-founder of Google, that says, and I don't have it in front of me, but to paraphrase, that being able to correlate all its contents would be the best possible thing in the world. That if you had a robot brain that knew everything, you'd be better off. So it almost seems like they're going precisely for what Lovecraft tried to warn us about in the 20s.
In the 20s. You also write that you, as a child, wished that you'd had a magic watch that could answer all of your questions, and now you do.
That's true. I don't know about all of my questions, and I sometimes get the disturbing feeling that I'm answering questions for somebody else.
No, maybe not ours. At least we're asking them in public.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how these things, when you can find anything that anyone's ever asked for, the questions do tend to get answered somewhere.
So how much do you figure Google does know about you?
They know a lot about a series of random numbers that represent me, and I don't think, I believe them as far as they don't connect their data about me with who I actually am.
But, sure, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, one day. until I, I'm glad I've never written an article speculating as to their intentions, because then they'd really have something against me.
We're talking with Rob Dubin, a writer for the Colbert Report, about his attempt to de-Google himself. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at npr.org. That's, of course, our website. Nothing to do with Google, but you might be connected somehow. Anyway, you give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Yes, you can use your Gmail account. Matthew joins us on the line. Matthew with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
Family members and I, we tried giving up Google for Lent.
That's a month.
No, that's 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
Worse than that. And, you try, doing, Yahoo, Lycos, trying to use, but it just doesn't work. There's only one. And, our Lent and give up. I mean, I try to explain, giving up things for Lent is not so simple as giving up chocolate or, whatever else, other silly things like that. There's greater meaning to it. And since it no longer fit the bill of what Lent was about, we decided, time to start Googling away. So.
and how long did you last?
I think it was almost a week. So that's, I never tried anything so stupid since.
And what was it that finally broke you, Matthew?
Probably something to do with school. That and the combination of Wikipedia is very dangerous.
Two in combination are very convincing, aren't they?
They somehow after 6 hours you wind up looking at 19th century Russian war art. And you have to back off for a second. Where am I? What day is this?
If it weren't for Google, we wouldn't know that Russia had art in the 19th century.
Oh, yeah?
No, I don't know that that's true.
Matthew, thanks very much for the call, and good Googling to you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. As you write in your piece, when you go to Google for information, we now tend to trust this information almost implicitly.
Yeah, it's true. I at least usually look for two or three people to have corroborated whatever it is I found. But from there, it's, especially if it's something that doesn't have a primary source readily available, it's pretty easy to just trust it and move on.
Here's an email from Audrey in Jackson, Wyoming. My friend's son asked her when she was little and she was learning to type on a typewriter of all things, how did she Google? We all got a chuckle out of this. There used to be things called encyclopedias. Yes, indeed. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Becca. Becca with us from South Bend in Indiana.
Hi.
Hello.
I wanted to comment on how ego-shattering Google can be, as I use it to settle many daily arguments in my life.
Oh, give us an example.
One day somebody, listening to Steely Dan, a Steely Dan song came on the radio, and they said, do you know that Chevy Chase used to be the drummer for Steely Dan? And I said, that's absolutely absurd. I wouldn't believe it for a minute. And I Googled it, and I Wikipedia'd it, as was mentioned earlier, and there was my ego laying all over the floor.
And of course, you learned that Chevy Chase is, in fact, a town in Maryland.
What's that?
It's, in fact, a town in Maryland.
Yeah.
People have always admired him for his high production values.
So Chevy Chase, of course, was a drummer at one point with Steely Dan.
Yeah, back in his college days. So, it's just any trivial thing that comes up.
And just think,
Easy just to prove someone wrong or prove yourself wrong in some cases.
Just think, if he'd stuck with it, he'd still be working.
He might.
Becca, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
As you think about the amount that Google knows about us, as you say, we have to believe that this is relatively benign. And for the fact of the matter is, as you write in your piece, when they send us those tailored ads that are supposed to strike us exactly where our commercial interests lie, 9 times out of 10, they're way, way off.
In my darker moments, I think of that as the false sense of security policy.
They're doing that, so you're getting ads for the Thighmaster because they're trying to put you off.
And, for every ad you don't look at, they know you didn't look at it because they saw that you saw it.
That's just going to make that next one discount Godiva even more effective.
Yeah. I also ate a lot of chocolate while I was writing this, just for comfort.
Just for comfort. So, and did you order that chocolate online?
Yeah, it's... It just popped up next to every email that I sent.
Let's get Susanna on the line. Susanna with us from Farmington Hills in Michigan.
Yes, hi. I use Google every day and absolutely rely on it. I'm a teacher for an online university, and I use it to catch plagiarism in my students, and it's absolutely phenomenal.
How does it work?
Well, I find a paper that is suspicious, and I take a phrase, I copy and paste it into the Google search bar, and it almost instantly locates the source of the plagiarism.
So if a student submits to you a paper that begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times."
Exactly. I've had papers that were, you know, one paragraph was completely from the New York Times, and the second paragraph was 100% from Foreign Affairs, and, you know, I'm able to find it in 3 minutes.
I'm really glad they didn't have Google when I was a student, Suzanne.
I know. It makes plagiarism easier, but it also makes it easier to catch.
Thanks very much. In fact, we managed to Google your piece, Rob Dubin, and it was, in fact, written by Mark Twain.
Oh. Yeah, I got his complete manuscript as a birthday present a long time ago, and I guess it just rubbed off.
Suzanne, thanks very much for the call, Susanna.
Thank you.
We're talking with Rob Dubin, who wrote a piece called "Just Let Me Check One Last Thing" about his attempt to wean himself off Google to celebrate that search engine's 10th birthday. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Amy on the line. Amy's with us from Temecula in California.
Hello.
Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Hello, how are you? Well, I'm a writer, and I got to tell you, Google is like crack for writers because it's so addicting to start writing about or researching something and then just get off on major tangents. And now with iGoogle, which I can pull all these cool little widgets like how to speak Yoda and writer's block and different things like that, then I spend more time Googling than I do writing, so it's a real pain.
How to speak Yoda? It is a writer you are?
I know. It's just one of those little things that when you really got a brain block and you're trying to get through something, sometimes a joke of how Yoda would say it, maybe the Force helps you a little bit.
this is how we spend our time, is it?
Well,
kind of makes Battleship look like a pretty intellectual exercise.
Yeah, well, they have this really cool tool on the iGoogle that you can, you know, get an opening line idea. It sort of melds different things together, and you can go off on a tangent. So,
have you ever tried that, Rob?
I haven't. I didn't know this existed. I'd actually. It's just like you. It's like you told me there was a guy by the docks who, you know, sell me a hit for $5 or something like that. This is dangerous.
Well, I spent a whole day or two of good writing time finding all of the cool widgets on my iGoogle instead of actually writing. So,
the amount that writers will go to procrastinate before they actually sit down to write is. I once had to finish the New York Times crossword puzzle every day before I would sit down and write. And of course, there were a lot of Saturdays I didn't write at all.
Well, don't even get me started about blogging, because blogging is writer's crack too. So it's instant, what I call instant artification. It's instant gratification writing, and it takes me away from actually working on what I'm supposed to be doing.
Amy, good luck to you.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye. Rob, do you think there's going to be a 12-step program pretty soon for Googling?
It would have to occur in real life, and, you know, in a colony in Vermont somewhere where they don't have broadband, and, you know, checking the internet takes 30 minutes at a time. I think it's too easy to slip back into it. And you really, you know, since Google has become so much more than just a search engine, if you really do want to avoid it, you have to really go out of your way to avoid it. I thought I was going out of my way, but it found me.
So it would have to be a combination of like est and dial up.
Yeah, the web would be a pretty naked place if you actually blocked traffic from Google's, you know, domain. It would be weird. It would be like, you know, half the buildings disappearing, or, you know, NPR without flute music.
Let's get Anna on the line. Anna's with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
All right, so my problem with Google is I work for a cell phone company and has since gotten a BlackBerry. And I have Google. I have everything from Google on my BlackBerry, and I even in my spare time, if I have 10 minutes to myself, I will sit there and just play with Google. I'll play with my iGoogle and find different, like, new quotes and different games to be able to put on my iGoogle. We show it to people. We've been addicting people to Google every day, you know, since I've been working for this company. But it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If I have 5 minutes to myself sitting there waiting for a doctor's appointment, doesn't matter. I will sit there and just Google things that I've talked about during the day or something that I've told somebody that I want to make sure was true. I use it even when I'm, you know, even when I'm just sitting there playing with my kids and want to show them something. I use it for everything. I think that if I were to do what your guest is doing and trying to go without Google for a day, I don't think I could get out of bed.
But you could probably Google and find a way to do it.
Exactly. You know what? If I could probably find some coping techniques on Google. There's no doubt about it. But, yeah, working for a cell phone company and selling smartphones to people, I will show them where my Google is and my Google Maps that I have on it and all of my different all of the different icons that I have on my smartphone so that, you know, it's actually a good selling technique, too, because so many people are addicted to Google, and knowing that they can carry it around with them is a pretty good selling tool.
Anna, I'm going to say something terrible. You're an enabler.
That's right. I am. I there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt. You know what? I should probably get stock in Google.
You're that crack dealer.
Talking about.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Anna, will
people come in to fix their phones and stuff because they need their fix.
Anna, we'll let you get back to your BlackBerry.
You know what? I will. I'm actually on it right now. So
I'm really sorry to have taken you away from it for a couple of minutes.
Here's an email from Jim in Syracuse, New York. I'd call in, but I'm too busy looking at Google News. Rob Dubin, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Rob Dubin is a writer for the Colbert Report. His op-ed ran in yesterday's Washington Post, and he joined us by phone from his office in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll have to Google that. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.